In fact, this is the first recession in Australia's history where profits increased during a recession. In every other recession, as you'd imagine, profits should drop. They should go negative. But over 2020, profits increased by 15%. And the reason for that is largely because of very large handouts to business and also JobKeeper and the way it was paid. So if JobKeeper was overpaid, that basically flowed into firms' profit and they became more profitable.
One for mum, one for dad. One for the country.
And there has never been a more exciting time to be an Australian.
Budgets are about choices, Fran, and you show what you value through the choices you make.
Dead, buried, cremated.
This is coal. Don't be afraid. Don't be scared.
The treasure.
Australia's basically done for. We'll just end up being a third-rate economy. You know, a banana republic.
How good is Australia?
Just...
G'day and welcome to Follow the Money, the Australia Institute's podcast demystifying the big economic issues in Australia and putting them in plain English. I'm Ebony Bennett, Deputy Director at the Institute, and today we're going to be talking about the federal budget, or as we here at the Australia Institute call it, Economists' Christmas.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I present the Appropriation Bill number 1.
This year's budget and last year's budget have been a bit different for the coalition government. Gone is the obsession with a surplus, or indeed the obsession with reducing the debt and deficit, as Treasurer Josh Frydenberg delivered a budget with big debt and big spending. But as long-time listeners will know, it's not just the size of the spending, but the shape that matters too. So how does this federal budget stack up this year? For a deep dive into the budget papers, I'm joined by our senior economist, Matt Grudnoff.
G'day, Ebony.
Thanks for joining us, Matt. I know this is your favourite time every year. What is it that you love about budgets?
Oh, I just love budgets. And the reason I love budgets is it is the one time of year when you get to cut through all of the spin. So politicians love to tell you that what you think is important to them if they think it will help you vote for them. And this is the one time when they can't just say everything's important to us. They have to allocate dollar votes to what they think is important. What the budget shows us is what they think is important. They might tell you endlessly that what's important to you is important, but if they didn't fund it in the budget, what they're actually saying is it's not really important to me. So the budget is a great time to cut through all of the polywaffle, all of the spin, and get to what the government's real priorities are.
Nice.
Stimulate the economy by spending big on a range of social services, tax breaks.
Big spending coalition has baked in deficits as far as the eye can see.
Real big spending budget from the Treasurer Josh Frydenberg.
Throwing $500 trillion over the next few years at the economy.
They've abandoned their debt and deficits rhetoric.
Just spending a lot of money makes you a lot of friends. The Prime Minister certainly bought a few tonight.
So, Matt, a lot of the headlines have talked about this being a big spending budget. Is that your analysis?
Well, certainly the government spent a lot of money, and gone are the days when we had the big scare campaigns about debt and deficit. The government has finally joined the rest of us, you know, all of the economists, all of the people out there who understood that the debt and deficit wasn't a problem. It was never a problem, and it's not a problem now. And hopefully, just hopefully, this new conversion that they've discovered will last longer than the next election, and they won't revert back to you know, this scare campaign about debt and deficit.
Yes, the big ticket items were things like aged care. There was a few other really big ones in there. But overall, it's much more public spending than we would normally see from a coalition budget. Would that be accurate?
Yeah, exactly right. So the government has basically targeted its spending at some areas that have been neglected for a long time. And we know they've been neglected for a long time because a lot of them have had royal commissions attached to them. They've been that neglected. So things like aged care, disability care. We've had a lot of money on gender equality stuff, which has been really important and long overdue, on mental health. These are the kind of areas where this stuff has just been festering for so long that the government really couldn't do anything else but face them and try and solve some of these problems.
Yeah, so let's start with gender inequality.
And tonight we invest a further $1.1 billion in women's safety. In this budget, we are making a further and targeted $1.7 billion investment in childcare, giving more parents, especially women, the choice to take on extra work.
It still shows the blokes in Cabinet still don't get it, that parenting and childcare is a whole of society issue. It is not a women's issue.
Do you honestly think the Morrison government would have had a women's package if it wasn't for the pressure they've been under in the past 3 months? I mean, in last year's budget, we were told that women were lucky because they'd built an extra lane on the highway, on the Barton Highway. That was their women's package. And you tell me the two things aren't linked? Of course they're linked.
And the budget papers actually show women's participation is predicted to go down next year.
So the government's obviously been in pretty dire straits when it comes to women's issues overall since the beginning of the year. But also last year during the pandemic, we know women were hit the hardest, and the budget that they delivered in October was by many, I think including myself, accused of being a bloke's budget that really heavily invested in male-dominated industries and stuff like that. How different is this budget?
Yeah, look, so it's not so much hard hats and high vis this year. They've certainly focused in on gender inequality. Their focus has been in three areas: women's safety, women's health, and women's economic issues. It was a big opportunity for them to do some really good things in that area. Unfortunately, almost all of the funding that they put forward, and the funding they put forward has been really good, but it's all temporary. Mm. And what I mean by that, so the budget always looks at the next 4 years. They call them the forward estimates. And it gives you how much they're going to fund each year for the next 4 years. Unfortunately, for all the gender equality, or most of the gender equality stuff, it all ends after 4 years. So it looks great in the budget.
So we'll fix it.
Absolutely. So a great example is women's security. The government is spending almost $1 billion on women's security. That drops to just $2 million in the fifth year. So it falls by 99% the moment the budget kind of ends, if you like. Yep. And women's health is similar. We have a massive fall off in the fifth year. In fact, the only ongoing funding in the women's space was childcare, and childcare actually benefits both men and women.
Yeah.
And is largely an economic issue that they should embrace regardless.
Yeah.
So really, they haven't had any commitment in this area, I think, and that's fair enough. And probably the best analogy I can give you is within the government, there's the Office for Women.
Yeah.
And it is the one part of government that's been asked to look at and try and improve gender inequality.
Mm-hmm.
You would think with all the new ministers for women, including a prime minister for women briefly there, that's an office that would need more funding. But rather than more funding, it hasn't had its funding increase. Rather, it's having its funding halved over the next 4 years. And that, for me, just is a great analogy for the commitment this government has to gender inequality.
Halving the budget for the Office for Women.
Yes.
I mean, it's still maybe slightly better than Tony Abbott as Minister for Women, but not by much.
Yeah, but not by much.
Tonight, we commit $17.7 billion in targeted and practical new funding to significantly improve the system. We will fund another 80,000 new home care packages.
That the quality of care in aged care is also linked to the quality of jobs. And there's nothing that says we're going to lift the skill, the wages, the conditions and the security of those thousands and thousands of mainly women workers who look after older Australians.
Yep. You make a good point.
So I want to come now to aged care. We've obviously, as you said, seen all the horrific stories coming out of the Royal Commission, and they made some really specific recommendations. Has the government taken those on board?
Yeah, the aged care gave us a really good picture of what was needed in the aged care space. And if you looked at all the recommendations that they made, you know, it would cost between about $10 and $20 billion a year to fund. So the bare minimum you could get away with would be $10 billion a year in extra funding for aged care to cover just the basics of those recommendations, all the way up to about $20 billion if you wanted to really make some big changes in that area.
And so how many billions are in this budget every year?
Well, the government announced $17.7 billion, which is more than $10 billion. Unfortunately, that $17.7 billion is over 5 years. So to put them in like for like, the bare minimum required $50 billion, and they're offering $17.7 billion, or about a third of the bare minimum. And again, like $17.7 billion is going to make a difference, but it is not going to fundamentally solve the problem. Are we going to hear these horrific stories in 10 years' time? Possibly, if this is all the funding they're offering. It doesn't solve the problem. It just almost makes it look like they've got something to talk about when aged care is raised as an issue. Yeah. Yes, we're spending $17.7 billion over the next 4 years. Isn't that great? Well, not really. It needed much more.
Yeah, and I think it's a little bit like JobKeeper, if I'm reading things right, in that there's not much in terms of mutual obligations, shall we say, on service providers to either put that to giving their workers a pay rise or making their food better quality. It's just kind of a bit of a nod and a wink. You should do a bit better and here's some more money.
Yeah, look, absolutely. So aged care suffers from the same sort of problems that childcare suffers from, in that it is heavily subsidised by the government, but they are ultimately, a lot of it, not all of it, but a lot of it are private for-profit organisations. And if the government gives them more money, then they can, you know, increase their profits or make the care better. That's ultimately a choice for a private business. And perhaps what we need to look at is we need to look at whether or not the government should be controlling more of this, or it should be a more not-for-profit rather than profit businesses providing care.
Over 99% of businesses employing over 11 million workers can write off the full value of any eligible asset that they purchase. So a tradie can buy a new ute, a farmer a new harvester, and a manufacturer expand their production line.
Moving now on to for-profit companies, the Australia Institute ran a pretty long campaign against the company tax cuts and pretty much succeeded in knocking them off for large companies. What is in the budget this year for companies?
The company tax cut was a big campaign for a long time that was eventually knocked off, as you said. But since we've seen the pandemic, the government has really focused heavily on handouts to business, more than I can ever remember. They have really focused on giving businesses money. In fact, this is the first recession in Australia's history where profits increased during a recession. In every other recession, as you'd imagine, profits should drop. They should go negative. But over 2020, profits increased by 15%. And the reason for that is largely because of very large handouts to business and also JobKeeper and the way it was paid. So if JobKeeper was overpaid, that basically flowed into firms' profit and they became more profitable. So if we add out, forgetting JobKeeper for a second, but if we just add up the largesse over the last couple of budgets, we come up with $53 billion over 4 years that business are getting. If they got the tax cut, Dave Richardson, our economist at the Australia Institute, calculated that they would have got $57 billion. Now, when you add in JobKeeper as well and the profits that they probably made out of that, they probably got more than their tax cut that they would have got from if they got that this tax cut down to 25% that they were asking for originally.
I mean, knock off one and they find another way to shovel that money out the door.
That's exactly right. And look, the BCA were almost bragging about this when they were saying, look, we'd prefer a tax cut, but, you know, if tax cuts are off the table, we're happy for these other investment incentives instead. And that's basically what they've turned them into.
Mr. Speaker, in this budget, our housing measures go even further, helping another 10,000 first home buyers build a new home with a 5% deposit, supporting 10,000 single parents to purchase a home with as low as a 2% deposit. Mr. Speaker, under the Coalition, home ownership will always be supported.
Now, I want to come back around to housing affordability, a term that Richard Dennis hates because he thinks it's meaningless. But there was a couple of big announcements in there, particularly, I think, around provisions for single parents to be able to have a much smaller deposit. Is that going to fix the housing affordability problem in Australia, Matt?
Look, housing affordability will only get better when one of two things happens. Either demand for housing decreases, and that could just be like a segment of demand. So, for example, if the government changed the incentives that investors currently have, the tax incentives to get into the market, unless investors got in, then that would decrease demand for housing and housing would become more affordable. Or they can increase supply. So, you know, if the government undertook a big heap of, say, social housing and brought a lot more housing onto the market, that would also make housing more affordable. All of the government's announcements in the budget, none of them do either of those things. If it doesn't decrease demand or increase supply, it will either have no effect on housing affordability or it will make it worse. And how will it make it worse? Well, if it increases demand for housing or it decreases supply of housing, that will make it worse. And what the government's got are a bunch of policies that benefit a particular segment. So single parents or first home buyers or something like that, by giving them effectively more money in the auction. And all that does, it doesn't benefit anybody except for people who own houses. All right, if you own a house and you're selling, you love these kind of incentives because all it will do is beat up the price at the auction.
Yeah.
You know, if you really want to take housing affordability serious, you need to boot out investors out of the market, or you need to add supply into the market. Mm. Until then, we're not going to see housing affordability get better.
And this budget will help create more than 250,000 more jobs by the end of 2022-23.
It's remarkable that they spent $100 billion last night. They racked up $1 trillion in debt. And yet still we've got real wages going backwards.
Low wages, low wage growth, low economic growth.
That workers' wages are not going to be rising at all over this 3-4 year period.
And I want to come now to wages. So we know wages growth has been at historic lows, and then obviously we've just been through a recession. Things have been pretty bad for workers out there. And I know previous budgets, if I recall correctly, have had some pretty heroic assumptions in there about wages growth. Yes. Is that in there this year?
Yes. Look, I mean, the wages assumptions since all the way back to about 2014, I think it was. So, you know, we're talking about 7 years of the most pathetic, awful assumptions around what's going to happen to wages. They keep predicting wages will begin to boom, and every year they go down. And, you know, to their credit now, they have muted somewhat their wages growth. They're still predicting that it will be up to almost 3% in about 4 years' time. That would be great if it happened. Again, I am highly skeptical, as I've been skeptical every year for the last 7 years about this.
Maybe they think if they just put it in the budget papers, it will happen.
Absolutely. You know, maybe wages will just magically rise if we write it down on
paper.
But
to be clear, they're not. There was nothing in the budget that increased public sector wages, for example.
No. So they're against public sector wage increases. Mm-hmm. They don't want to see the minimum wage increase by much. They're not interested in the historic wage case for aged care workers at the moment. So all of their policies are about suppressing wages, mm-hmm. And then they're surprised when wages are suppressed. So, you know. But what's really interesting about the predictions about wages growth in this budget is that over the next 4 years, the budget papers, even with those heroic assumptions about wages going up, are going to see real wages fall. That is, the CPI, inflation, is expected over the next 4 years to be higher than wages growth. So the amount of stuff that you're going to be able to buy
with your take-home pay,
will be lower in 4 years than it is today, ooh, according to the budget papers. So not only, you know, are we predicting, you know, wages growth to increase when, you know, historically it has not done, but even now it's gotten so bad that people are actually going to start seeing their wages going backwards.
Mm. Mr. Speaker, our industries and our regions depend on affordable and reliable energy. That's why the government is unlocking vast gas reserves in the North Bowen and Galilee basins and investing in hydrogen-ready gas plants. We're also shoring up our fuel security by helping local refineries to keep operating here in Australia.
There's $35 billion in excise going to the coal industry for the diesel excise. So there are ways we could be saving money. This debt doesn't have to be as big as it is.
We must remember this. If it wasn't for the iron ore industry, and it wasn't for the coal industry, which these people are trying to kill, and it wasn't for the gas industry, then you wouldn't have had a reduction in your deficit that found the money for your childcare, your aged care.
Another bad thing, climate change. Yep. We do know, obviously, it's one of the most pressing issues that we're facing. We had the Black Summer bushfires last year. It's, you know, there's some pretty big impacts of climate change that we're actually seeing right now. Tell me what's in the budget for climate action.
Yeah, well, as I said at the start, the budget is about priorities. And if it's not in the budget, it's not a priority. And guess what? Climate change is pretty much not in the budget. In fact, if you scour around, you can find just under $50 million over the next 4 years for renewables and batteries. Mm-hmm. But that's pretty much it. Okay, so on one side, you've got less than $50 million for renewables and batteries. But on the other side, we can look at, well, what are they funding stuff that's going to increase climate change? Well, they've got $1.6 billion over the next 10 years for major polluters, for things like turning fossil fuel into hydrogen. So hydrogen could be good if it used renewables, but this is for fossil fuels. Burying their emissions, CCS.
Oh, my favourite.
CCS is only 5 years away, Ebony.
It's always only 5 years away.
5 years away for 20 years.
It has been. And I know the Australia Institute, we've done some research. We've spent over $1 billion and we still have no commercially ready operating CCS project anywhere in Australia.
No, absolutely not.
Well, and we're giving it more money.
We just need to give it a bit more money and suddenly it'll work. They're for polluters to upgrade their equipment and to help them meet their already pathetic and weak targets. Mm. But not just that, just after the budget, the government announced another $2 billion for liquid fuel security for oil refineries. And that's on top of the $8 billion we spend on fuel tax credits. So all up, that's just under $12 billion on the one side for polluters. Yep. And on the other, we have just under $50 million for renewables and batteries.
So more than 10 times the spending on fossil
Many
fuels.
More, yes, yeah. Yes, definitely.
Well, that's depressing, Matt. Now, Richard Dennis is currently doing his national Econobabble tour to promote his new and updated book. I'm sure there's always terms of Econobabble that, you know, are peppered through a budget. Is there any things like that that jumped out at you?
Yeah, look, there's one, it's a particular bugbear of mine, record funding. You hear ministers say it all the time.
The Morrison government is providing record funding for schools, for hospitals, Medicare, mental health, aged care and disability support. The government is investing record funding in education, brings our record investment in aged care and record funding to guarantee the essential services Australians rely on.
We're spending record amounts on this, or we're spending record amounts on health, or we're spending record amounts on whatever it happens to be. Now, funding for stuff should go up with inflation and population every single year. So that means that every year, if it goes up, is the record year.
Yeah.
Every single year is a record year. And unless the government's actually cutting it, that's the only time you wouldn't have a record year. And if you also think, if the government didn't fully fund it, if they only increased it by, say, half the inflation rate, that would mean next year the government would be providing less services. If the services have gone up in value and I haven't fully covered it, then you'll provide less services. But guess what? That would still be a record year because it went up by half of inflation.
Yeah.
So the great econobabble word that we hear all the time, and particularly in this budget, is record funding. If somebody's telling you it's record funding, they're probably trying to deceive you.
So, Matt, the final thing that I want to touch on is the overall tax reform agenda.
Under the coalition, taxes will always be lower and hard-working Australian families will always be better off.
So obviously the Australia Institute has done quite a lot of research around that, you know, there's no evidence to suggest that a company tax cut would increase growth, for example. But we've also done quite a bit of work around income tax cuts, and the government, way before anyone had heard of COVID, way before the pandemic, legislated some pretty huge income tax cuts. You've talked about a lot of the funding in the budget being temporary, but those tax cuts are permanent. what's the picture for tax reform that comes out of this budget? Was anything attempted? And what's coming down the line for people in terms of those income tax cuts?
Yeah, look, there's nothing as far as tax reform goes. The government seems to have completely abandoned it. They extended the LMITO, the low and middle income tax offset, for another year.
That's a temporary for low and middle income earners.
That's right. And they extended it for 1 year last year and they've done it again this year, but it could end next year, basically. But as far as those stage three tax cuts go, you know, I mean, they were legislated 7 years before they were due to come in. And the government said, don't worry, the economy is going to grow strong and we'll totally be able to afford them. They won't be a problem. Now that the economy has tanked, the government is saying, well, the economy has tanked and what we really need is a tax cut. So when times are good, the solution is a tax cut. And when times are bad, the solution is a tax cut. And incidentally, as far as stimulus goes, high income tax cuts are the worst form of stimulus because high income earners, we know, save a big chunk of their money. So there are far better ways of stimulating the economy. And also, it doesn't actually come in till 24, 25. And by that stage, hopefully, the recession will be behind us and we won't need actually any stimulus.
Mm.
But these tax cuts primarily go to high income earners. More than half of them go to the top 10% of taxpayers.
More than half just to the top 10%.
Just to the top 10% of taxpayers. So if you are on $200,000 a year, you will get over $9,000 a year in tax cuts.
Sorry. $9,000 a year.
And $9,000 a year, you will get a tax cut in 2024. If you are in the bottom 20% of taxpayers, you will get nothing, not a single dollar.
What if you're in the middle there? Like, what about the people getting the low and middle income, the LMITO?
Yeah, so the LMITO, when the LMITO ends, people will actually have a tax increase. So that tax offset will be gone. And so the question is, does the stage three tax cuts offset fully the LMITO loss? And the answer for everybody earning $88,000 a year or less is the answer is no. So if you are part of the 80% of taxpayers who earn $88,000 or less a year, the stage three tax cuts and the scrapping of the LMITO will result in you paying more tax, not less tax, more tax than you do this year. If you're in the top 20%, you will get a tax cut. And most of that tax cut, the majority of it, is for those right at the very top end who are going to get, as I said, $9,000 a year.
If you're earning less than $80,000 a year right now, you're getting the low and middle income tax offset. Yeah. That ends. Where are you left? Worse off or better off?
You are better off on the stage three of our tax plan, stage two, stage one, all compared back to 2017-18 when they
didn't. Compared to this year, Treasurer, are you going to be worse off?
But you're not comparing it. You're not comparing an apple and an orange.
No,
you're comparing
with respect, I am. I'm asking you where.
No, you're not.
Well, compared to what's in their wallet today, and what's going to be in their wallet in 3 years' time, they're going to be worse off.
No, they're not. And can I also point out to you?
Well, Matt, that seems like a good place to wrap things up. Thanks very much for the budget wrap-up for 2021.
Thank you very much for having me.
Do you know how many sleeps it is until next year's budget?
Not off the top of my head, but I have to start counting them.
For listeners, Matt's been coming in for months to the staff meeting every week.
Only for the last 50 days. 50 days, I counted it down.
Telling us how many sleeps there were to the budget. Thanks so much for that, Matt. This episode was recorded on Tuesday, May the 18th, and things may have changed since recording. You can visit australiainstitute.org.au for all our latest research and content, including our 2021 federal budget wrap. We're on Twitter at the Oz Institute with an AUS. My Twitter handle is ebony_Bennett with a double N double T. And you can find Matt Grudnoff at Matt Grudnoff, GRUDNOFF. This episode was produced by Jennifer Macy, and our theme music is by Jonathan McFeet from Pulse and Thrum, with additional music from Blue Dot Sessions. Stay safe out there, everyone, and thanks for listening.